Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Christopher Frank about his book, Workers, Unions, and Payments in Kind, The Fight for Real Wages in Britain, 1820 to 1914. Chris, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for agreeing to be on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Okay, I am a 19th century British historian. I'm an associate professor of history at the University of Manitoba, where I've been working since 2003. Before that, I did my graduate studies at York University under the supervision of Doug Hay. I worked on his Master and Servant project, which he did with Paul Craven. I completed my PhD there in 2003. And the project kind of, my current work kind of grows out of things that I began there at York.
I was wondering if you elaborate upon that. What was it that led you to focus specifically upon this topic, which I must confess, as a British historian myself, I didn't know as much about as I felt like I should have after I finished your book. But it is one that really, you know, speaks to a lot of elements in British history.
Yeah. Well, my first book, which was my dissertation at York University, in that I studied the resistance of workers to the penal sanctions of employment law, a body of laws known as master and servant. And these master and servant laws were characterized by a double standard of sanctions, which treated employees' breach of contract as a criminal matter for which they could be imprisoned or whipped or a variety of things. And treated employers' breach of contract as a small-scale civil matter. And in studying the 19th century resistance to these laws and the penal sanctions of employment law, I came to kind of realize one of the insights was how, as a matter of law, employees were held much more tightly to the terms of their contracts of employment, whereas employers enjoyed a lot more flexibility in terms of fulfilling their promises to workers. This kind of disjuncture between the abstract theory of freedom to contract and how it was experienced on the ground and in the courts. And in collecting these kinds of cases of master and servant, I began coming across a number of forms of the practice of paying workers in truck or the practice of paying workers in goods rather than currency. Because frequently this was a way for an employer to evade the agreement, the contract, by providing an employee with goods at an inflated value and thereby reducing the amount of real wages that they were paying. And as I got into this, after the publication of my first book, I decided that I wanted to study truck further and kind of expand upon this. And so I soon found the common form of truck was an employer compelling an employee to receive or spend part of his or her wages at a company-owned store. This is frequently done by having long pay periods and permitting employees to take advances on wages earned but not yet paid, provided they spent those wages at the company-owned store on goods that were inflated in price. And in practice, this meant workers received less value for the wages they were promised, and employers exercised greater control over their lives. And then as I got into that, though, I soon realized that there were a variety of other ways in which employers raked back wages that they had promised to employees. I found the prevalence in kind of marginalized and sweated trades of disciplinary fines that were often very arbitrary. I found employees being compelled to pay for damaged products, and the employer would judge when a product was damaged and take that out of their wages. And in many cases, employers would also deduct from the wages of employees what we would consider some of the ordinary costs of doing business, providing heat, light, standing room in the workplace, deducting from workers' wages the materials that went into the products that they produced. So I came to this new project to explore the prevalence of these practices and also the variety of ways in which employees and unions and government inspectors sought to reduce or eliminate them.
What you're describing in the book is not so much a single campaign. And this one of the things I thought was very interesting was the complexity of it, because you begin with the legislation that was passed in 1831, I believe it was, that supposedly addresses this problem. And then you show, how on one level the question of what this legislation did from a legal perspective, and then also the challenges of enforcement, and how this seemed to be a problem that just persisted throughout the 19th century and defeated, successive efforts to address it. And you get into just, what some of the issues were in terms of why the legislation was successful, why it was so difficult to address it, and how it really persists, even beyond the period that you're talking about in your book.
Yeah, the 1831 Truck Act was passed through the efforts of Edward Littleton, who was from Staffordshire, a politician from Staffordshire. And he had been exposed he had witnessed a lot of the practice of truck, because Staffordshire is one of those parts of the country where truck was quite common in a variety of industries. In the late 1820s, workers in a variety of trades, as well as retail shopkeepers, began asking for legislation. And Littleton was able to secure the 1831 Truck Act really over the strong objections, kind of liberal political economy objections of Joseph Hume, who argued that people should be free to make their own bargains, whatever they entail. If a worker agrees to accept bacon for their wages, it's not for the state to intervene and that sort of thing, made that argument. Littleton was able to secure the 1831 Truck Act, and the 1831 Truck Act made it illegal to pay servants or artificers in a variety of specifically listed trades in anything except for the current coin of the realm. And if a worker was paid in truck, that worker could find two magistrates. The two magistrates had to not be in the same trade as the employer and the employee. And the magistrates had the authority to pay any wages that were paid in truck to force the employer to pay those wages in money and to fine the offending employer as well. And in the 1831 Truck Act, there was a list of specific things that employers could deduct from an employee's wages that would not count towards wages, defining those wages. And the 1831 Truck Act ultimately is a failure, although one of the things I argue in the book is how we interpret whether or not a law is a success or a failure. In some cases, we have to take a slightly broader look at the legitimating functions of the law. But in terms of its practical use in the courtroom, many of the difficulties in the law, one is that it was employee initiated, so that if an employee, an employee would have to make the choice to prosecute his or her employer. And of course, this would almost certainly result in losing your employment and being blacklisted in the region, which is a significant disadvantage. Another disadvantage in using the 1831 Truck Act is that although magistrate summary justice offered affordable and ready justice, it still was expensive because magistrates, especially in coal and iron districts who were not in mining or iron working, were not easy to find. And so in some cases, you know, an employee might have to travel to find a magistrate who heard the case. And then finally, also, many magistrates were just ideologically hostile towards regulatory legislation. They felt that this was an interference with freedom to contract. Many magistrates treated an employee suing under the Truck Act as committing a type of fraud, that the employee has already been paid in kind, and now the employee is seeking to be paid a second time in money. And so they were also resistant in that way. And so as a result, at the magistrates level, the law was interpreted as narrowly as possible, and they were loath to inflict significant fines on offending employers. And in the cases that got appealed to the higher courts as well, higher court judges, strongly influenced by classical liberal political economy and freedom to contract ideology, were also very hostile to this legislation and sought to interpret it in the most narrow way possible, that kind of narrowed its scope and narrowed definitions of coercion and made it much more difficult to enforce in that way. So throughout a lot of the 19th century, labor would mobilize periodically in different places to try and secure stronger laws that would strengthen the prohibitions against truck.
Your description of that process to me was so fascinating because it really, I thought, capture a lot of that dilemma very well, and how even if they do, you know, even if they're willing to take action under law, and even if they can find magistrates who are reasonably sympathetic, sometimes the fines simply weren't worth the amount of legal effort necessary to get a judgment, a favorable judgment in the end.
Yeah, and especially too, because for many of the employers, especially at some of the larger coal and iron works in Wales and Staffordshire and Western Scotland, the financial benefit employers receive from these company stores are so substantial that the fines inflicted by magistrates are not going to discourage them necessarily. And also, it became rather easy for employers to disguise truck with kind of plausible deniability. So for, as I suggested earlier, having a very long reckoning period, but permitting employees to take advances on wages earned but not yet paid, and everybody would understand that you needed to spend those advances in the company store or else you'd be refused future ones. But the employer could deny this, could deny this arrangement. And this kind of compulsion is really difficult to prove. And so one of the stories in the book is the disjuncture between legislative intent of Parliament, how the law operates on the ground, how the higher courts interpret it, and in some cases in the later chapters, the way in which the regulatory state can sometimes manipulate the law to serve different purposes as well.
One of the other things that you talk about in these early chapters that I thought was really fascinating was the opposition to truck that comes not from the employees, but from businessmen outside within the community who are not necessarily part of this direct employer-employee relationship, because as you point out, they have this vested interest, they have these businesses, but if they're not part of the company store, then basically they're finding that their traffic, their business is being taken from them because these employees are being forced to shop in the company stores because that's in effect where the credit is, and that's where the employer is providing all sorts of incentives and nudges in order to get them to patronize them.
Yes, in the early anti-truck prosecution societies, these societies in Staffordshire and Wales, that attempted to bring the 1831 law into force and, you know, offered to look after workers who were displaced for coming forward and fund prosecutions and lobby for new legislation. Retail shopkeepers were very prominent in this and provided a lot of the funding. They make strong economic arguments that company stores take money out of circulation with the expansion of truck. It reduces the middle class and ratepayers and is bad for local economies. And they're forceful about this. And employers, on the other hand, who pay in truck, sometimes use this paternalist argument to justify paying workers in truck, saying that the real people to be afraid of are retail shopkeepers who get employees into debt. That employees buy in debt and therefore, you know, ensnare them and that sort of thing. And that working class people are not as good at managing credit relationships as their middle class contemporaries. And therefore, truck is a service provided by employers to keep them out of the clutches of these kinds of things. In Scotland, there was a process of small debt collection known as the arrestment of wages, which allowed a shopkeeper before a payday to come go to a small debt court or magistrate's court or a sheriff's court and get an arrestment claim that would force an employer to hold the employee's wages and give above the amount that was determined necessary for subsistence to the shopkeeper. And this is really inconvenient for employers because these arrestments would all land on payday and that sort of thing. And so there was a movement in Scotland to modify the arrestment of wages to make it less exploitative. And shopkeepers argued, well, if you do this, then there's going to be an expansion of truck. And at the same time, there was a campaign to have tougher truck laws. And the truck master said, well, if you do this, you're going to have more arrestments of wages. And so two exploitative systems for supplying workers, got to stay in place because they could argue the elimination of one would result in the growth of the other, you know, rather than eliminating both through shorter pay periods.
So when do you see the first efforts to try to modify or change the law in substantive ways? And what is the fate of those efforts?
Well, there's a couple of them. There's one in the 1850s, the early 1850s, after a substantial, there's a South Staffordshire Anti-Truck Association, which is a pretty significant effort to use the law, to bring the law into force and prosecute truck masters in Staffordshire. They expend between 600 and 800 pounds and I think secure around 200 convictions. Bring the law into force. But after 3 years, they're not confident that they've made much of a dent in the extent of truck because, as I said before, with small modifications, the employer can avoid prosecutions. The fines are not substantial as well. And so they began agitating in Parliament for legislation that would increase the penalties as well. And in the 1850s, this legislation founders in part because of, as I said before, two powerful arguments in Parliament that are really actually the arguments that are very consistent against government intervention against truck throughout its history. The first argument is the classical political economy freedom to contract argument that it's an inappropriate use of state power to intervene with people's making their own bargains, that workers and employers should be able to reach their own agreements about the method and timing of wage payment, and it's not for the state to intervene in this way. And the argument is that if truck is really a grievance for workers, workers will find employers who don't pay in truck. And this, of course, ignores a great deal of legal and practical reasons why it's not always easy for an employee to simply pick up and find other work elsewhere that I go into in the book. But the second argument that is kind of contradictory that was made by employers who were implicated in the truck system was this paternalist argument that argued that truck was good for workers because it allowed employers to exercise a form of sumptuary control over employees, that in particular it would prevent male employees from drinking their wages, and that the company store enabled wages to get into the hands of the working class wife. There's a real kind of gender domesticity element on both the pro-truck side and the anti-truck side. Both sides seem to agree that in a well-run household, the wife runs consumption, and which system of wage payment better enables her to do that is a source of debate. And also throughout the 19th century, there's a great deal of debate about what system of wage payment has the impact of different systems of wage payment upon the consumption of alcohol, especially with male workers. But the kind of peculiarity, the kind of paradox of these two arguments, which were effective to keep anti-truck legislation at bay in the 1850s, is you have this argument that on the one hand, workers should be entirely free to make their own contracts, their own labor contracts in the labor market. But on the other hand, they should not be free to spend their own money, that they shouldn't be completely left alone to navigate markets and consumption, these kind of contradictory elements.
And that's actually one of the things I thought was really fascinating about that was just how, you know, they were contradictory, but at the same time, they appealed to such a wide swath of political thinking at that time. You had the paternalistic argument, which appealed to many Tories, and you had this ideological argument, which, you know, probably, you know, warmed the hearts of a lot of people that were reading classical liberal theory or embracing it, and how, you know, it didn't matter, they were contradictory. They were both equally, by you can peel off enough people who might, you know, into opposition to it so that you could effectively shut down change.
Absolutely. In the 1870s, in some ways, with the emergence of so-called new model unions, they kind of lean into these arguments a little bit in ways that also prevent legislation from passing. In the 1860s, there's an emergence of the Trade Union Congress. And some of the larger unions that in labor circles, it's a little bit controversial, but they're referred to as new model unions, these larger amalgamated unions of skilled workers that charge high dues and provide benefits to their workers. And rhetorically, they try to avoid strikes and they their leaders adopt conciliatory rhetoric towards employers. And their leaders also work very hard to project respectable notions of masculinity, to try and demonstrate political maturity and worthiness of citizenship, you might say. And one of the more prominent of those people is the leader of the Scottish miners, Alexander MacDonald. And in the 1860s, he works very hard at a parliamentary strategy to try and win legislators over to creating tougher truck laws. And he's actually able to win over the editor of the North British Daily Mail, this newspaper man named William Cameron. And he undertakes an extensive investigation into the prevalence of truck in Scotland. And he goes into great detail about the how exploitative it is. And he really kind of undercuts a number of prominent arguments that had been made against truck. And this expose is published in the summer of 1870. And it gets put into pamphlet form and sold, and it gets picked up by the Times. And members of Parliament began talking about it as well. And it leads to a truck commission in 1871 that is the most one of the most thorough social investigations of the era. They interview nearly 600 witnesses in 10 different locations, I think. They ask, I might be wrong, I think they ask over 45,000 questions of these witnesses. They ask questions to miners, miners' wives, mines inspectors, ownership, a variety of the wives, a variety of different individuals. And the final report of the truck report is kind of remarkable because Alexander had been seeking the weekly payment of wages in the current coin of the realm with as few deductions as possible. And the report mostly endorses that. The report doesn't say much about deductions from wages, but it endorses the weekly payment of wages and discounts a lot of the paternalist arguments as well.
And go ahead.
But it also addresses the question, why don't workers who are paid in truck vote with their feet? And it does this by kind of adopting some of the rhetoric of the new model unions. It divides workers into provident and improvident workers. And it says those provident workers, those respectable men worthy of citizenship who are members of trade unions, they do actually only work for money-paying employers, and they don't seek advances on wages, and they can manage their money sufficiently to avoid these things. But it's the more dependent workers have no choice. They're not able to leave their employment and go elsewhere, and they're dependent upon borrowing against future paydays. And these are the workers that are exploited by truck. And in addressing that kind of political economy argument, however, you kind of undermine yourself by leaning into the paternalism argument and giving giving legislators the opportunity to not pass a law. But as a result of this 1871 Truck Commission, the Trade Union Congress is able to convince the government to put forward a legislation that would have greatly strengthened the truck laws. It would have expanded the truck laws. It would have increased the penalties. It would have also enabled workers to get a substantial portion of their wages weekly as well, which would have been very beneficial. But the legislation was killed. Once the legislation gets introduced and passes its second reading, employers come screaming to the government, and the government has to walk back its commitment to the workers. Over the strong objection of the Trade Union Congress, the legislation is amended, and then the Trade Union Congress asks Parliament to just drop the legislation instead. But after that, you begin to see more working class members of the Trade Union Congress getting elected to Parliament as well, that they're beginning to kind of question the benefits of the lib-lab relationship in some cases.
Yeah, it was one of the parts that you mentioned that I thought was fascinating, which was how you start to see greater discussion, you know, right after you have the passage of the 1867 Reform Act. And as you point out, that's not a coincidence. You know, workers are starting to get the vote. And so you can't just simply, have the employer's perspective. You have to have that worker's perspective as well. And yet the way the citing of the legislation, you're talking about 1871, the committee, you're talking about, it's never seems to be a particularly high priority of the governments when they're coming in. It's in 1886, what you describe, and I'm getting ahead here, is it's inherited from the liberal, the 1897 Act, about how it's basically inherited from the liberal government because, in effect, they got to it late in the game, and so it gets carried over, and so the new Home Secretary finds he has to deal with this issue, and the way he deals with it ultimately proves to be very unsatisfactory because it's something that isn't really high on his radar screen either.
Yeah, governments are very reluctant to legislate in this manner. There is a pattern amongst a lot of the attempted truck legislation, as they oftentimes begin as kind of private member bills, and the government reluctantly picks it up. Or in some cases, it's necessitated from the the factory inspectorate encountering such practical difficulties so many practical difficulties that the government is kind of compelled against its will to pick up this legislation, because it's quite politically unrewarding, because there's such a gap between capital and labor on what's acceptable here. Employers want the least intrusive legislation the smallest amount of possible regulation possible, affecting the fewest number of workers, where workers want truck workplace fines and deductions to be entirely eliminated. And so it's very hard to bridge the gap. And one of the things that with that 1896 piece of legislation is, you were talking about the 1876 Act. Well, I'm sorry, the 1867 extension of the franchise. Well, after 1884, the government in 1887 and 1896, Tory governments are kind of anxious to demonstrate to working class voters that they're capable of addressing their concerns. And after the 1896 Act, Tories were astonished at how little gratitude they got from workers because they passed this law that they thought put some restrictions on the ability of employers to fine or deduct wages for damaged work. And workers believed that these things should be entirely outlawed. And many of them mistakenly believed that under the law, they already were illegal. And so it's kind of, you have this peculiar situation in 1897, where there are a couple of by-elections that the Tories expected to win and did not win. And the press blamed it on defections from working class voters who were angry about the passage of this Truck Act that, you know, the Tory government had intended to be a benefit on that front. So it's not a politically rewarding area in which to legislate. And so very frequently, the government comes to it only reluctantly.
That was one I thought was particularly fascinating, because you describe how, as part of the 1896 legislation, that fines now had to be openly posted, and how workers suddenly are interpreting this as, oh, now you've legalized fines, and they see the fines as an outgrowth of legislation, when it's designed to have a bit more honesty about them, and so it ends up backfiring in the face ends up having the opposite intent and really, you know, angers the workers.
Those placards are quite interesting, yeah, because of, you know, suddenly this big coat of fines appears on the wall, and it's interesting. I talk about in Belfast, this law is applied, and these placards with lists of fines go up in spinning factories, and it leads to a gigantic strike in Belfast. And there's tales of female workers tearing the placards off the wall as they walk out to go on strike. And eventually they're able to negotiate a reduction in the number and the amount of fines. As well. The placard was a late amendment. In the original bill, they wanted fines to only be legal if they were part of a written contract between the employee and the employer. Many employers thought that this was not practical, and so they amended it to say, or if you prominently post a placard with fines in the workplace. And some employers thought, or some advocates thought, that that would actually shame employers into reducing the number of fines, that if you have to post these things, in addition to making them less arbitrary, you know, seeing them on the wall, some of them might appear exploitative and employers might be embarrassed about them. One politician later on thought that employers should have to post their list of fines for the public to see as well.
And that gets to, you know, the argument you're making in your book, which is that you're not seeing that sort of dramatic change with legislation. It's more that over time, as awareness increases, all these efforts, they're not achieving that dramatic effect, but they are having an effect.
Yeah, and it's hard because the previous scholarship on Truck, the only British monograph was written by an economist named George Hilton. And he was writing at a time when there was an effort underway by employers in Great Britain to repeal all of the truck laws because they had become rather inconvenient after the Second World War for employers. And that kind of shaped his approach in many respects, because a major argument of his study of the Truck Acts, and he really only studies the 1831 Truck Act, he gives a brief mention of the 1887 and 1896, but his argument was that government legislation never had any meaningful impact on the amount of truck that was practiced in Britain, that truck rose and fell according to economic factors and also organized labor. And that most certainly is true, that places where organized labor was strong, truck tended to be less likely to exist. But I argue in the book that this takes kind of a narrow view of the meaning of statute law, that while truck prosecutions under the 1831 Act and even 1887 and 1896, while they were not hugely numerous and they were not always victories in court, there were a number of high profile defeats and that sort of thing, as well, that's not the only way to judge, that the law has the power to legitimate certain practices. And it was around the law that opposition, the trade union movement, retail shopkeepers organized. They kind of, in these campaigns, they greatly publicized the hardships caused by truck. And in doing this, it made it seem less respectable. One of the things that you begin to see when employers are arguing against legislation in 1871 or in the 1880s, they're no longer really full-throatedly defending truck. You know, they're saying, "I deplore truck, but this legislation is, you know, an unnecessary interference with the freedom of contract." You begin to see it kind of prefaced in this way to suggest that truck's not a reputable way of doing business, but, you know, this kind of going on. And later on, with the factory inspectors, and especially the female factory inspectors, although their rate of prosecutions under the 1896 acts for unfair fines and deductions of various kinds, they win 75% of their cases, which is a lower rate than they win under the Factory Acts. They win 98% of their Factory Act prosecutions. So they endure a number of high-profile defeats. But despite this, I argue that they have an impact on this by the dissemination of expert knowledge. They produce these annual reports that get reprinted in the newspapers. They're in high profile cases. They're in constant communications with well-published trade union leaders who are passing raw statistics back and forth. They remonstrate with employers. So many employers want to have a good relationship with the factory inspectorate. And so when a female factory inspector comes to the employer and says that modern managements don't fine anymore, this begins to carry weight and it begins to change practices. And so in this way, the law can have sometimes disguised impacts on behavior as well. And especially with the regulatory state, a lot of kind of behind the scenes discussions with employers and inspectors results in much bigger transformation than actually prosecuting reluctant ones in court.
So we've been talking around the 1887, 1896 acts. I was wondering if you could perhaps explain how those acts came to pass and how they changed the law regarding truck, and ultimately why they proved to be inadequate.
Oh, okay. The 1887 legislation was the work of a liberal named Charles Bradlaugh, and he managed to get it passed in a Tory majority parliament. Bradlaugh is a fascinating individual who had a pretty remarkable life. If you're interested in the Victorian era, he's one of those kind of personalities that it's interesting to read on. Walter Arnestein wrote an interesting book about him as well. And when he entered Parliament, he began agitating on behalf of workers about the extent of truck wages continuing in Scotland. Practices such as the charging of poundage, which meant that when employees wanted to get an advance on their wages, they would often at times have to pay a 5% fee for this advance on wages that had been earned but not yet paid. And so Bradlaugh and others remark that these employees are, you know, paying interest on money they've already earned, which seems kind of unfair. A remarkable number of company stores still existed. And so Bradlaugh begins kind of agitating for truck legislation. And the government sends a factory inspector up to investigate in Scotland. And he uncovers a fair amount of truck continuing, also a substantial amount of poundage. And he also uncovers what is a growing grievance, which is unfair deductions from wages that workers are complaining about as well. And so while the government actually initially didn't want to publish this report, Bradlaugh made so much noise in the House of Commons that eventually they did have to publish it. And then the trade unions began agitating as well. And Bradlaugh and another MP from Scotland, Donald Crawford, introduced private member bills. And then at a certain point, the government decided that it would help Bradlaugh's bill along and it would satisfy this. What Bradlaugh's bill would do is it would expand the truck laws to cover all manual workers. And it would include workers in Ireland for the first time as well. It would entrust enforcement of the laws to the factory inspectorate as well. And it would regulate some of the unfair deductions from wages, but not all. And this bill, because of the kind of crowded parliamentary session, was frequently worked on after midnight. One of the things in going through the House of Commons journals, you know, they would pick up this bill in committee and they would be rewriting it in committee in the wee hours of the morning. And different interests were trying to shape the bill. The trade union Congress was trying to shape it to make it something that would provide weekly pays and would provide no more fines and unfair deductions and these sorts of things. And ultimately, employers were able to weed out the parts of the bill that would have would have provided for weekly pay for workers. And so when it passes in 1887, now the factory inspectorate takes over enforcing the truck laws. But by this point, workers' concerns have begun to shift towards workplace fines and deductions from wages. And Bradlaugh believes that under the 1831 and 1887 Truck Act, these are illegal. He believes that the 1831 and 1887 Truck Act requires employers to pay the entirety of wages owed in the current coin of the realm. And therefore, deductions that are not explicitly allowed for in those Truck Acts are paying workers something otherwise than the current coin of the realm. Now, the fact is, although Bradlaugh believes this and the entirety of the labor movement believes this, the courts have never endorsed this interpretation. And in fact, there's quite a lot of prominent case law that suggests otherwise. But Bradlaugh continues to push the inspectorate to try and test these cases. And again, this is another one of those examples of legislative intent versus how the law is enforced in the ground versus the high courts versus the regulatory state. And so there's all this confusion as to how the law applies to these kinds of questions. And as we move into the 1890s, a kind of new variable comes on the scene. And this is in 1893 when the Female Factory Inspectorate is created. And this was created kind of as an, well, actually, it had been a kind of a 20-year project, an ancestor of the Women's Trade Union League. Its leadership had originally wanted female factory inspectors who were from the working class, who had a practical knowledge of factories. But by the time we get to the 1890s, Emma Dilk, who is an important figure with the Women's Trade Union League, she wants there to be the appointment of middle class female factory inspectors who would have the proper standing to kind of remonstrate with employers. One of the things that was revealed in the early 1890s in the Royal Commission on Labor is that male factory inspectors had a blind spot with respect to sweated female labor, that female employees in these marginal employments did not come to these factory inspectors with their grievances, and the male factory inspectors did not kind of ask probing questions about these women. And so as a result, in 1893, Asquith, who at that point, I believe, is Home Secretary, he introduces the first two female factory inspectors, May Abraham and I think it's Mary Patterson. And then by 1895, there are five of them. And then on the eve of the Great War, there are 21. And they're grouped into a separate female factory inspectorate. And they have special jurisdiction over female labor in sweated trades. And one of the things that's important about that is that that workplace fines and deductions are the largest grievance and are most outrageously abused in those sectors of the economy where there's a substantial portion of non-unionized, marginal female and juvenile labor. And in fact, one of the big issues in the early female trade union movement is workplace fines, deductions for damaged work, this sort of thing as well. So these female factory inspectors began traveling, and they began traveling in Ireland. They began remonstrating with employers, and they began their interpretation of the Truck Act is that not paying workers the entirety of wages owed in the current coin of the realm is illegal. And so these fines and deductions are illegal. And then panicked employers go over their head and write to the Home Office, is this the case? Because, you know, we don't think this is the case. And what's the case law? And so there's all this kind of confusion generated. But these female factory inspectors are churning up a lot of evidence of almost extortionate deductions as well. And so Asquith in 1895 begins producing a bill that will place some regulations upon employers' ability to fine and deduct from workers' wages. And then the Liberal government falls. And then the Tory government and the new Home Secretary is Matthew Ridley. He picks it up and produces slightly modified legislation. The 1896 Truck Act regulates fines and deductions. So workplace fines, for a fine to be legal, it has to be part of a written contract or a posted notice prominent in the workplace that says what you can be fined for and the amount that will be taken. You can only fine workers for things that hurt the business, and these fines are supposed to be, quote, fair and reasonable according to all circumstances of the case, a phrase that is very open to interpretation. Also, it says that deductions from wages for damaged work, it has to be part of a written contract or a posted notice. The employer can only take the estimated damage that has been caused by the workers' damaging of the product. And the amount taken should be fair and reasonable according to all circumstances of the case. And then finally, for things like heat, light, materials, etc., the employer can't charge more than the item costs. And the deductions are supposed to be fair and reasonable according to all circumstances of the case. And so these laws will be enforced by the factory inspectorate, employers could be fined for violating this. And as we said earlier, this law is popular with no one. employers see it as a huge intrusion upon their ability to run their own business. And workers are outraged because they believe that fines are already illegal under the Truck Acts because it's not paying workers in the current coin of the realm, even though the courts have rejected that interpretation time and again. And so, as we said earlier, workers and workplaces start seeing these placards going up and they get very angry and that sort of thing. But I try to argue that during the existence of this act and the years prior to the outbreak of the Great War, the factory inspectorate, especially the female factory inspectorate, actually uses the act to good effect in many cases, despite the fact that the courts were very hostile to it. They're able to remonstrate with employers about the terms of the new act. And because of the kind of regulatory nuisance of administering these fines and taking deductions from workers' wages for damage, many employers began just abandoning these practices voluntarily. And as the factory inspectors began to generate expert knowledge and disseminate that expert knowledge, they began to kind of produce this narrative about modern managements and the way modern managements behave, that modern managements don't fine, that they don't charge workers for materials that go into products, that this isn't how they work. And this gets picked up not only by trade unions, but by the press, and even in some cases, many employers. And many of these factory inspectors hold up the examples of prominent employers that abandon fining. So, for example, Cadbury abandons all fines and deductions and reports back that it's had an improvement in workplace discipline and that sort of thing as well. So I argue that although the female factory inspectorate and the factory inspectorate in general has some very high profile defeats under this legislation that really are kind of difficult for them, in general, behind the scenes, they're able to actually bring about a lot of good in some respects.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm completing, there was a lot of leftovers from the truck project. In particular, I'm looking at truck and the truck acts in the 20th century, especially after World War II, and the impact on the payment of wages for workers in those cases. I've also, in the book, I didn't write as much about the practice of truck in the Hebrides and the Shetland Isles. And I kind of wanted to say more about that as well. So I think I'll be pursuing an article looking at that as well. And then finally, I was also kind of thinking of maybe looking at some of the earlier truck legislation that really hasn't been studied as much. My old supervisor, Doug Hay, has looked at a little of it, but I think there might still be some work to do on that front. So I might explore some of that as well.
Well, when you've completed that and you have the next book out, we'll definitely have to have you back on the podcast.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Well, Chris, thank you very much for your time. I hope you have a wonderful day.
You too. Thanks.